you were just speaking about, like, what is direct action and what did it mean to us and things like that, and that's where I wanted to start it off, as far as, you know, some of, you know, what were some of your experiences with direct action in the years before RTK? Like, what were some of the issues that you were working on and organizing around, and what was the police repression like in New York?
Okay. Well, I feel really excited to talk about the direct action experiences and the jail time experiences and in R2K in the context of the work that we were doing in New York at that time. I was part of an organization called Student Liberation Action Movement, and it was mainly student, people of color, women of color-led organization that, you know, as I said, it was based at City University. And I think what was one of the things that was really special about SLAM as an organization in terms of tactics and strategy is that since its inception as a student organization in, you know, the mid-90s, it really, really embraced the idea of direct action. And so when R2K came around, I feel like that was completely in line with, you know, our philosophy about, you know, what it meant to do organizing, what it meant to take action, to stand up for the things that we believed in. And so, you know, being a student, people of color based organization at the City University, as you can imagine, we were facing all sorts of issues from, you know, tuition hikes, you know, cutbacks in really important programs like open admissions. And then we were facing, you know, really deep community issues, whether it was like, you know, immigration rights or police brutality. And where direct action is important is that, you know, we really felt that it was important to take immediate action, to organize the constituencies that we were a part of, you know, whether that was students or the communities that we served in, and really stand up to the powers that be, so to speak, and say in a very direct, immediate way, that we were not going to stand for, you know, the kind of changes they were trying to make to the university, for the resources they were trying to steal from the community, and just for the perpetuation of oppression that was coming down in New York at that time. And I think that SLAM succeeded in really using direct action as a really successful tactic throughout any one of those issues. And what I mean by successful is that, you know, direct action, I think for us meant, you know, everything from, you know, a mobilization and a rally, you know, to somebody who we're trying to bring our issues to, like the Board of Trustees at CUNY, or whether it meant participating in direct action and blockading, you know, the Brooklyn Bridge in protest of the killing of Amadou Diallo. When we took those actions, I think what was really unique about SLAM and a lot of the progressive, I think, people of color led organizations in New York at that time, I think what was really special about that is that that action had a real, it was really driven by a sense of dignity, that really, really, I think, came across in how we carried ourselves, how we carried out the action, how the media that accompanied it, the culture that surrounded it, and it said that it was very both concretely and symbolically, we would take actions that if you participated, it literally transformed your life, right? It allowed you to say in a very concrete way, wow, I stood up for what I believed in, right? And I protected my community. I stood up for my community, right? And along with, you know, literally stopping something from happening, right? Literally fighting back. And I think that was really, really transformational, I think, for any one of us who participated in that. And I think when we came into the R2K mobilization, I think we brought that experience with us. I know myself, you know, I had probably participated in you know, arrest situations at least 5 times before coming into R2K. And when we came, we felt that this was a very natural issue for SLAM to be a part of, because if we're talking about a Republican mobilization in the year 2000, we're talking about, you know, right-wing conservative policies that are just a perpetuation of what was already negatively impacting not only the City University, but CUNY. And we wanted to make sure that that voice was going to be brought to the table in terms of the issues that were addressed by R2K. But we were also saying, you know what, our communities are being affected, so we are going to participate in shutting down the Republicans.
I just love about the dignity, because I feel like sometimes now, like direct, what people might call direct action or sometimes civil disobedience is different things, protests, you feel like you're going through the motions, right? Like, we weren't going through the motions. It was about really, like, coming from the heart and stuff, so. There's something about that.
Yeah, Susie, I mean, it's funny because I feel like when I read your questions about R2K, you know, what is direct action mean? Like, I think about, you know, the direct action that's happening today, and the media coverage that it's receiving. And, even at that time, the media, tends to frame things as destruction, right? Like destruction of property, et cetera, versus people taking a stand for what is right, you know? And I think that our job as organizers, as political activists, is to make sure we contribute as much to framing things in a way that really is about that dignity, that really is about saying we're taking action because the destruction that's happening in our communities can be tolerated. And so we're standing up with dignity. We're standing up to that versus, you know, and trying to bring across, you know, what is the kind of world that we want to build? Right. If we don't want this corporate dominated, you know, world that we're living in today under like literal corporate destruction, then what kind of world do we envision? You know, how do we see our communities? What kind of economy do we want to see? What kind of a service system do we want to see? You know, what kind of a school system? What do the libraries look like? What do the parks look like? And I think that's the message that we hope, you know, to bring across in direct action. And I feel like I, you know, if I can give an example, I feel like of something that really inspired me in terms of direct action, again, was the mobilization in 2000 around Amadou Diallo. And SLAM was organizing at Hunter College, which is one of the colleges at City University. And I was so amazed to see the organizing that happened at Hunter around not just getting students involved and coming out to demonstrations, but the core of students that came out to say, I'm literally going to put my body on the line for Amadou Diallo. I'm going to participate in a civil disobedience. And these were students that were from like the Christian Intervarsity Fellowship Club. They were students who had not only had they never been arrested before, but they had never even participated in a mobilization around tuition hikes, right? And so you had students coming out of the woodwork saying, you know, this is like against like my basic values. You know, this is something that I need to stand up for, like for myself as a human being, you know, and the impact that had, you know, was so transforming that I think that everyone who participated in that and who saw it with their eyes, I remember the media coverage that we got was tremendous. And it was not framed as these kids who are destroying things, right? It was framed as indignation against, you know, the murder of Amadou Diallo. And so I think that direct action, you know, and if, you know, and not to be, you know, cliche and talk about Martin Luther King, but I think it needs to be said that, you know, that it really is fueled by this deep humanistic core value of the kind of society we want to see happen, and to say that we're willing right in this moment to say we want to build that society, and that's why we're putting our bodies on the line against the destruction of that.
It seems like it was sort of historically important that R2K decided to work on police and prisons as I remember it, but was that part of what inspired you to want to work, to participate in it?
Well, I have to say that I think that, you know, I feel like R2K was really seminal in that it really brought together the global justice direct action movement that really saw its birth in the movement in Seattle. You know, the anti-globalization movement met the grassroots, social justice community, the grassroots community working in people of color and immigrant communities. And I think that that was what was so seminal about it. And I think that SLAM actually played a leading role amongst people of color-led organizations to say, no, we have to be a part of R2K. We have to be part of this direct action movement. We have to bring that issue to the table because, you know, it is the issue. They are the issues. And so I think that that was one of the really motivating factors that we felt like these are the issues that have to be at the forefront, you know, of any national movement, you know, and any call for justice, you know, for global justice. And I think the other piece, and maybe this is moving into, you know, what we learned or what I certainly learned from the direct action movement is that I think that, I think in terms of political movements, I think that, you know, historically, you know, sort of the people of color left or more grassroots groups, and then, you know, what might traditionally be seen as a white anarchist scene, and particularly at that time period coming out of Seattle, like a white anarchist direct action scene, they were seen as separate and disparate. Where I think what we learned from R2K is that we actually had so much to learn from one another. And I think one of the things that really struck me, and it's interesting because I don't think this is traditionally what, what people would stereotype the anarchist, activists or comrades as, but, I found the Direct Action Network in particular to be just very, very highly organized and sophisticated. And so the demonstrations and the mobilizations and the direct action that was going on was not just simply, okay, let's just randomly go out in the street, but they were organized in a very sophisticated way in terms of, you know, how are people going to take action, you know, throughout this mobilization. You know, there was really, really amazing structures of organization, not only that were strategically and tactically important of actually, like, shutting the city down, but that were amazing experiments in democracy, right? Like, we would all be allowed to participate in these real efforts at saying, you know, what do we want this to look like? We all had a part in creating that. And so I think that SLAM had the insight, you know, as, you know, again, and I can't repeat enough, as, you know, student-based, grassroots-based, you know, women of color, you know, queer folks of color, you know, based group in New York to say, you know, we need to build these bridges. We need to connect, you know, to these other movements, right? In order to have the strength to make an impact. And I think it was a tremendous learning experience, you know, on our part for that reason, you know, and for me in particular. And I think that I cannot say enough about, like, the strategy in terms of direct action and the efforts at, you know, creating a democratic process, you know, with all its contradictions, and of course we can get into that, but how important it is, and really, really that the bigger picture for me is that that's where the power lies, is in these different communities and these different sectors of the movement to come together is what's really dangerous. Because then it really means that we're going to have an impact and have the opportunity to really, really, really make a fundamental change for social justice.
Mm-hmm. And in some ways, that might have been some of the reason for the repression. I think.
Yeah.
Oh boy. Is it, were you arrested in the puppet warehouse?
I was arrested in the puppet warehouse, yes.
What was, so, I mean, I guess I would ask you to really tell your story, you know, as far as, being arrested and then being sent up to State Road to the county jail.
Okay. Yeah, well, I was, you know, I was part of, you know, the mobilizations that were happening the day that the puppet warehouse was raided. And I happened to be with, you know, with my crew of folks at the puppet warehouse. And I think maybe when I talk about the puppet warehouse, the things that come to my mind are, both the really inspirational experience that I had, as well as, you know, just the contradictions between, just within us as a movement, you know, and some of the efforts that were being made that I think are really, really kind of important to highlight so that we can learn from them. And I think that one of the interesting things for me, again, was this participating in this direct action network, the different efforts at democracy and the idea of coming, of trying to work in consensus, right, in a context of sort of a, you know, a minute-by-minute, heightened mobilization context. And I think that, you know, there were a lot of good efforts, but I think a lot of mistakes made during that time where the idea of consensus was taken, I think was utilized in such a mechanical way that we couldn't even make real decisions that were really, that would bring the best results from what we were trying to do, which was have a mobilization that, and that was, which also potentially hurt us and made us unsafe. You know, so I think that for me, part of my story was seeing again in these efforts at democratic participation, you know, that these are real, they're not just, you know, concepts, you know, that we talk about. They're not just, they can't be used mechanically. Right. And so just to give an example, when we were at the puppet warehouse and it was being raided, it was there ended up being obviously a very large sort of impromptu meeting. And, you know, what we really needed to do was, you know, get out of there very quickly.
Oh.
And it just turned into like an 80 person meeting with, you know, folks, self-identified kind of direct action anarchist, you know, folks, you know, just kind of fighting over, you know, what is consensus and who's allowed to speak in this moment and kind of shutting people down. But really, these were just like young activists who were scared and not knowing what to do. And I think we're hiding behind the notion of a consensus process. And, I, you know, I can look back 10 years later and say that, you know. So I think for me, that was really interesting, you know, and I really, anytime that I talk about my anarchist, you know, comrades, it's never disparaging. It's really out of an effort to just bring honesty to the table, you know, in my learning process. And so for me, that was sort of my initial, like, you know, my initial experience in the puppet warehouse was like, wow, like what is going on? You know, how does this, you know, supposedly democratic process become suddenly this mechanical thing? And so where I had been going to these amazing meetings, strategy meetings, where, you know, the consensus process was, you know, I learned how it can be used really well. Then I also learned lessons like in the puppet warehouse where it can just become mechanical, you know. And so that's kind of how, you know, my trip to jail started. I'm trying to think of how to, you know, what was the essence of being in jail for me? And again, bringing it back to, I guess when I think about talking about R2K and my personal experience, being a member of SLAM is, you know, I think the big idea for me and the big lesson that I learned was how important it was for activists of color, organizers of color, and specifically women of color to participate in direct action, to be arrested, to have been in jail. Like, that experience of being in jail taught me more than ever the importance of folks of color, from the communities they represent to be part of the direct action movement. And the reason I say that is because we had such an opportunity to interact with the entire jail system in a way that I think it had an impact that just can't be underestimated. So when we were arrested at the puppet warehouse, we were transferred to the local holding jail, the local jail, you know, the initial holding pen, wherever.
The roundhouse.
Yeah. The roundhouse, that's it. We were held there, and immediately, you know, we were in the context of all of these, you know, police officers and all of these, you know, just regular secretaries and all these people who worked for whoever worked in the roundhouse and sort of the local police department. And so it just hit me like immediately how these were folks, you know, just like regular folks, you know what I mean? Latino folks, Black folks, you know, working class white folks. And they really looked at us like they had no idea what was going on. So immediately there was this opportunity to begin to relate with regular folks who are immediately tied to the prison system, to police and prisons, to the prison industrial complex. And for me, I immediately realized when we were arrested that this was really going to be our job. And when I say our job, I mean the maybe handful of women of color who were in jail. Because I would love to see the actual statistics of all the folks who were arrested, but to my recollection, there was but a handful of women of color who were arrested. And that was very evident from the beginning. And so, you know, I think our entire approach, and specifically myself and a woman who went by the name of Plum Blossom, that was her name for the action, she and I immediately became aware that we needed both to build bridges with our white anarchist comrades, and then we needed to build with the people who were inside of the jail, right? And that was not just prisoners, but that included the staff who was there, because that could be our brother, that could be our sister, right? That could be our next door neighbor, and that they were a priority. And so, for example, we chose not to, you know, resist the arrest process. You know, there were folks inside who got naked, who were, you know, and it was all part of, you know, bottling up the system. So that it was a strategy that, you know, okay, you could say, okay, I understand the logic. But I think for us, that immediate relationship with people, right, who were directly involved with the prison system, right, was much more important. So, like, if I could have a conversation with a cop and let him know what was going on, I knew that that would have more of an impact than, you know, me kind of stomping around and taking off all my clothes, right? That's what began to be our experience. And when we got moved out of the roundhouse, we got moved to, and maybe you have a better recollection of the jail we were sent to, because we were actually sent to
I don't remember what it stands for, but I remember all the women, but I don't remember too well.
Yeah, I forget what it's called, but it's sort of, outside of Philly and Pennsylvania. We got sent to the prison, and I apologize that I don't recall the name of the prison, but we were in a couple of different holding cells. You know, we were sort of in a maximum security initially, then we got moved to general population, and then we got isolated again. But in each of those experiences, you know, from the roundhouse and moved to prison, they were experiences where we had the opportunity to really interact with, again, folks who were directly involved with the prison system. And so we had the opportunity at one point to be in general population. And, you know, we were in a prison cell that was sort of open, and there were, you know, it looked like almost like a large open dorm room. You know, you had bunks and then individual beds, and, you know, you had like sitting kind of gathering areas. The television was on, you know, where the women who were in prison were just, you know, this is their home. This is where they lived. and myself and some of the other women had the opportunity to be there. And we knew that we had to make connections with those women, you know. And I remember there was a woman, one of the lady prisoners was like braiding Plum Blossom's hair. You know, we had people offering us food, you know, asking us, you know, if we needed anything. And, you know, we made a point to sit and talk with them about what was going on, right? What were they watching on television, right? They were like, yeah, we saw those cop cars and, you know, we saw people slashing the tires and, you know, like people were junking these cop cars and they were really excited about it. They were really excited to see it. But the truth is they had no idea. They had no idea why that was happening. And when they heard us talking about, this is about you, you know, like, why are you here? You know, what is this about? Why is this jail filled with queer women, with Puerto Rican women, with Black women? When they heard us talking about that, you know, they couldn't believe it, you know. So for us to be there in that moment, you know, and make connections with those women was so important, you know, in terms of even, you know, bringing to prison the message of what was going on the outside, making them a part of that. And simultaneously to what we were doing, you know, the men were actually, and, you know, you'll probably get another interview about this, but simultaneously the men were organizing, right? They tried to make communication amongst themselves, but with the male prisoners as well, and came up with a list of demands for, you know, what was happening in prison for the men in general, not the male activists, but what was happening for the men in general. And so it really gave us a unique opportunity, again, to connect with the folks directly impacted by the prison industrial complex, to make that connection in a way that we would not have otherwise, right? And in a way that we could never have learned the lessons ourselves, right, of what it was actually like to be inside of the prison at that time.
I think I might remember you saying something when you got out about, like, how the police in the street were different from the guards in the prison. Like, did you feel like you could talk more to the guards in the prison than like...
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I felt like when we were in prison, I just felt like they did not come to us with an antagonism. You know, they weren't treating us with antagonism. I think that they were doing their job and there was a sort of a detachment, you know, an initial detachment from us. And I think that when they were agitated, when people were aggressive towards them or defiant, that they responded in kind. And when, you know, I feel like the efforts that we made at just making connections, then they just treated us like, okay, you know, you're cool people, you know, and I'm doing my job. You know, which is absolutely very different from, you know, any treatment that I've received in the streets. And I have to say, I don't think it's a mistake that they bring out when you're, and I don't think that the difference in the cops' race is a small thing. I think that in my experiences of being arrested and in being arrested in Philly, that the people they keep, the cops that they have on the outside tend to be white. And then the cops on the inside tend to be people of color, you know, and that's my experience, you know, with R2K. Yeah, I feel like my experience, and I think the point that I think that I'm trying to make is that, you know, it's not that like, oh, you can, you know, like a cop is part of the prison system, right? And so by default, it's not the person that he is, but the role that he takes on. Right. And that's what's so it's really important to remember. That's why it's not, oh, I'm just doing my job. That's not OK. You know what? You can't just do your job if your job is fundamentally to like to oppress people. Right. But I think the point that I'm trying to make is that even within this really repressive context, that the role that we bring as activists. Right. And the message that we bring and how we relate to another person and connect with the human part of them and connect with the part of them that knows this way better than we do, right? If the cop is a man of color, right, or a woman of color, that this is her job, she knows very well what's going on in the streets of Philly and what the repression of Timony is like. They know much better than we do, you know. So for me to attempt to make an enemy first rather than connect with that person, you know, to touch that part of them, I think is a grave mistake. And I feel like that's one of the lessons that I really took from that experience, because I think that's relevant whether, you know, in any context, any organizing context, you know, and especially if we hope to connect with folks in all sectors, you know, in the mainstream and all the institutions that we're related, that we relate to and that we're a part of, those are the folks we're relating to. You know, they're just like the CEO, or they're just like the cop, you know, they're just like the person working in that prison.
Mm-hmm. You know, I really feel like they've been able to sort of try to co-opt a lot of communities in Philly by, or sort of cut communities apart from themselves, because it's like half the community's in jail and half the community's working at the jail. The number one employer of African Americans in Philly is like this private security firm, and they don't have guns or like police powers, but they're really low paid. But it's like, I feel like it's part of that whole like trying to like tear the community apart. And one thing I really admire about prison activists here is like they have this prison health summit every year, and they invite, you know, workers from the Philadelphia prison system, and they participate in the discussions, and a lot of the discussions are about activism, and you can see like people care, and they really have a lot of ideology about like blaming, like they blame the parents and they'll blame, you know, it's amazing to watch those contradictions like play out in the room. My friend Laura McTighe has, she's the one who started that prison health summit that they have every year where those meetings happen and or the workshops happen. And she was in RCK, and I actually had dinner with her tonight. And she was saying about how, like, being in jail during RCK, she had already been a prison activist, and she said she remembered the people from SLAM, and, like, having already been working on prison issues, like, she felt like herself and people from SLAM, like, learned so much from being locked up in, you know, with other people in the system.
Wow.
And I think that probably influenced the fact that she invites employees of the prison system to participate in this, basically an activist summit. It's kind of amazing.
That is so, that's so amazing. That just sounds like such an amazing, amazing, like, project, you know. And I think, you know, what you reminded me of, Susie, was that, you know, when I, you know, most of my organizing has been in schools, right? And, you know, I think it's very easy because, of course, I mean, what an obviously, like, repressive institution, right? We're talking about prisons, right? But what is the, you know, what is the flip side of that are schools, you know? And when you talked about the ideology of folks working in the prison institution, it reminded me of the ideology of folks who are in our educational institutions. So, you know, most of, you know, I think about the work I've done, like, in high schools and organizing parents and, you know, parents coming to a meeting and we're trying to organize, you know, to get a new school building and, you know, more access for, you know, for the school community to the resources it needs. And the ideology of the parents, of the faculty, you know, it resembles those that you're describing, you know, of folks who work in prisons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's about saying, well, you know, there's us and there's them, you know, and if people would just do this, then we would be okay. You know, and I think that that's what oppression does, you know, right? It turns the people affected, you know, into their own jailer, into their own oppressor. And then again, it just, again, highlights for me how important it is, like, the project that your friend is working with. It's called Prison Health Summit.
That's roughly the name of it, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, well, it just reminds me of, like, how important it is, again, to have projects that are, you know, you're working directly within folk, within the community that's being impacted or that's part of these institutions. You know, whether you're, you know, working with folks in prisons, when you're working with folks in, you know, if you're a social worker in a hospital, if you're a teacher in a school, you know, for me, all of that is the same.